Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Come all of you good workers.
Hey, Chris Garlock here with this week's Labor History Today.
When they were murdered in 1981 in the Union Hall of the Alaska Cannery Workers Union, that was a message.
That's from Learn Yourself, which is part of We Do the Work, a local worker radio program that airs each week on Skagit Valley Community Radio, KSVR. Today, we'll hear about LELO, formerly known as the Northwest Labor and Employment Law Office, and founded in Seattle, Washington, in 1972 when black workers from the United Construction Workers Association, Asian workers from the Alaska Cannery Workers Association, and Latino workers from the Northwest Chapter of the United Farm Workers of America came together to work for racial and economic justice. LELO's work in the 1980s was framed by the assassinations of two of its founding board members, murdered in 1981 on the orders of former president of the Philippines, Ferdinand Marcos. Evidence showed that they were assassinated in retaliation for their successful work to link workers' struggles in the U.S. to workers' struggles abroad.
Puerto Ricans were desirable when immigration restrictions were and still are imposed on guest workers, and they were undesirable when the country opened the doors to guest workers.
That's Ismael Garcia Colon discussing his new book, Colonial Migrants at the Heart of Empire, about Puerto Rican migrant farm workers and their labor experiences in the post-World War II United States, on the Working History Podcast. On this week's Labor History in 2, Rick Smith tells us about Jane Addams, who was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for her lifelong advocacy for working-class women and children.
During the 1894 Pullman workers' strike, Jane Addams visited the community and had meals with the women workers.
That's all ahead on this week's Labor History Today. But first, here's a quick word about a special program that's airing tonight.
Boomer Jones.
Hi, I'm Bob Martinez, International President of the Machinist Union. Tune in Sunday, September the 6th, as we bring you an encore performance of the 1950 radio show, Boomer Jones. Boomer Jones wanted a better life and found it, first as an apprentice and later as a journeyman machinist. Join us September 6th at 7 p.m. Central.
Boomer Jones.
Boomer Jones airs at 8 p.m. tonight on WCPT. You can listen online. Go to WCPT820.com and click on Listen Live. If you missed tonight's broadcast, we'll be featuring the show in a special Labor Day edition of Labor History Today, airing coast to coast on the Mutual Network on September 3rd, 1950, the day before Labor Day. Boomer Jones was the first radio program of its kind ever attempted by a union, and tells the story of the old-time boomers, as union organizers were called, who helped build one of the largest industrial trade unions in American history. Next up is a program called Learn Yourself, which is part of We Do the Work, a local worker radio program that airs Tuesdays at 5 p.m. and Sundays at 5:30 p.m. Pacific Time on Skagit Valley Community Radio, KSVR, and a variety of other stations nationwide. Learn Yourself is hosted by Connor Casey, labor archivist for the Labor Archives of Washington. Today, we'll hear about LELO, formerly known as the Northwest Labor and Employment Law Office. LELO was founded in Seattle, Washington in 1972 when black workers from the United Construction Workers Association, Asian workers from the Alaska Cannery Workers Association, and Latino workers from the Northwest Chapter of the United Farm Workers of America came together to work for racial and economic justice. LELO's work in the 1980s was framed by the assassinations of two of its founding board members, murdered in 1981 on the orders of former President of the Philippines, Ferdinand Marcos. Evidence showed that they were assassinated in retaliation for their successful work to link workers' struggles in the U.S. to workers' struggles abroad. We Do the Work is part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, nearly 70 shows focusing on working people's issues and concerns.
In 1981, there were assassination of two labor leaders, and this certainly happened in the past, but this was in 1981. So how did the assassination of Salome Domingo and Jean Vernes impact Lilo?
Jean Vernes and Salome Domingo were co-founders of Lilo. As Nemesio said, both Jean and Salome led in the Alaska Cannery Workers Association and led in the filing and leadership of the three companion lawsuits against the Alaska Cannery companies. So when they were murdered in 1981 in the Union Hall of the Alaska Cannery Workers Union, Local 37 of the International Longshoremen and Warehousemen's Union, that was a message to the movements that Salome and Jean were part of, was to stop that work. And that included the work of Lilo, that included the work in Local 37, or continuing to organize around the canneries for the rights of cannery workers. That meant the work that Salome and Jean were doing in the Union of Democratic Filipinos, the KDP, to stop building international solidarity between the workers in Local 37, the workers in ILWU, and the workers that were under the dictatorship of Ferdinand Marcos. And so murders are often done, political assassinations are often done to silence workers and to stop the important work that those workers are conducting.
And Cindy, what was your role in bringing the assassins to justice?
Well, I was at the time living in Oakland, California. I was in the National Education Department of the Union of Democratic Filipinos, the KDP, which was at that time the only radical Filipino organization in the United States based in the Filipino-American communities. I moved back to Seattle immediately and became part of the Committee for Justice for Domingo and Vernes, a broad community organization that was composed of the labor movement, elected officials, 8 community outreach groups that reached into every community, including women's, Filipino community, Asian community, etc., to build that broad-based support to get justice for Salome and Jean, because we knew that they weren't just ordinary murders, but they were political assassinations. Ultimately, 2 years later, when we decided to pursue more than just the hitmen in the murders who belonged to a Filipino gang, and we filed a civil suit in U.S. Federal District Court, we took our work nationally and internationally to the Philippines, where the orders for the murders happened. And I led that struggle with many, many other people, and I became the national coordinator and have continued to do the work around Salome and Jean's case. 37 years later, we have just reopened efforts to hold the U.S. government accountable for those murders, because we were never able to bring them to court. And we have gone to the FBI because we know that an FBI informant was at the site of the murders, and we want the FBI to tell us and the U.S. government to tell us, why was there an FBI informant at the site of the murders on June 1st, 1981?
Well, you brought with you today a book, now that you're an author, A Time to Rise. Tell us about your book. Why did you write it to begin with?
It's actually a collection of over 30 stories of members who composed the KDP. And it was actually a 20-year project.
20 years.
It was an effort that was well worth it. It's co-edited by Rene Cruz, who was the editor of the Ang Katipunan, the newspaper of the KDP, and Bruce Saxenia, who was also in the national leadership. The timing of this book is very important, and the significance of it, because of what's happening, not only because it's important that people who made the history write their own history. Oftentimes, history is written by other people who don't hold the same lens as you, don't really know the experience of why or the reasons why you conduct that work. And so that's why we continue to pursue this project, even though it took so long. All of these stories are personal stories of people, how they entered the movement, experiences in various campaigns, as well as reflecting back, was it all worth it? And it's an important book to look at now, given especially what's happening in the Philippines and in this country. A major part of KDP's work as a radical organization was at the time to build a movement to end U.S. support for the dictatorship of Ferdinand and Imelda Marcos. And our movement in the KDP, as well as other Philippine organizations that conducted that work, was the significant part in ending U.S. support for the Marcos regime. Today, we have in the Philippines another rising dictator under Rodrigo Duterte. And unfortunately, the conditions are a little bit different because he has mass support for his impending dictatorship. We are facing in the Philippines an effort for them to dismantle all of the democratic institutions that were set in place after the overthrow of the dictatorship. And over 20,000 people have been killed because of Duterte's policies around drugs. And so it's important that people look at the history in the Philippines, but see that even though the U.S. does not have its bases there, the future of the Philippines as a democratic nation is in great danger under the present president. In the United States, we have many lessons to impart for the young people that are becoming active in this country. And so we hope that through this book, young people will read and want to build an intergenerational movement for democracy, not only in the United States, but also the Philippines.
As this regime, as totalitarian as it really is, impact the lives of workers?
Well, there have been many workers and organizers that have been killed under that so-called drug war. At this point, murders can be carried out with impunity. All you have to do is say, he's a drug dealer, he's a drug user, and he can be killed. And the president has said, go ahead and carry out those murders. You will not suffer any consequences. At this point also, we are very concerned that with the potential imposition of fascism and the dismantling of the democratic institutions, we may be looking at the same conditions that happened under Marcos, where trade unions are outlawed, and maybe the only unions are those that are sanctioned by the president, by the government. And so we are very concerned. And in fact, we think it's time that the labor movement in this country pays attention to what's happening in the Philippines and begins the work again that Selmy and Jean started of taking positions against a rising dictatorship in the Philippines and in support of the workers.
So why would you suggest that our listeners and the public in general, for all that, should read your book?
Well, I think that it's important that people learn about the history of both people of color in this country, as Nemesha was saying, but also about radical movements in this country. I'm sure that most people do not know about the radical movement in the Filipino community that began back in the 1920s in this country, when large numbers of Filipinos first immigrated into this country. Many of the labor leaders in the union movement in the immigrant communities came from the Filipino community, both in terms of the United Farm Workers, the agriculture workers, as well as the cannery workers. Many people do not know that it was Filipino farm workers that began the lettuce strike, the Salinas lettuce strike, and actually were the basis for the formation of the United Farm Workers.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, the year was 1860. That was the day that Jane Addams was born in Cedarville, Illinois. Her family was wealthy, and her father served as a state senator. In 1881, Jane Addams visited London with her friend Ellen Gates Starr. There, the two women were inspired by Toynbee Hall, a settlement house which worked with the poor and working class in the city. They decided to establish a similar effort in Chicago. They founded Hull House in an immigrant neighborhood of Italian, Greek, and Jewish workers. Hull House grew to become a complex of facilities that offered kindergarten, daycare, lectures, and cultural programs, and an important space for women trade unionists to hold meetings. The women of Hull House became one of the leading proponents for workplace safety in the nation, pushing for laws and reforms to help workers. During the 1894 Pullman workers' strike, Jane Addams visited the community and had meals with the women workers. She was able to convince the workers' strike committee to agree to sit down to arbitration, but the Pullman company officials staunchly refused to negotiate. The refusal of the company to bargain and the rising anger of the workers was an eye-opener for Jane. Later, she reflected, quote, "During all those dark days of the Pullman strike, the growth of class bitterness was most obvious." Before the strike, she wrote, quote, "There had been nothing in my experience that had revealed that distinct cleavage of society which a general strike, at least momentarily, affords." In 1931, Jane Addams was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for her lifelong advocacy for working class women and children and her strong stand for peace during World War I.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome to Working History, a podcast on the New Books Network channel, New Books in the American South. Working History is a production of the Southern Labor Studies Association. Learn more and become a member online at www.southernlaborstudies.org. I'm series host Beth English, and today I'm speaking with Ismael Garcia Colon, Associate Professor of Anthropology at the City University of New York, College of Staten Island. We're discussing his new book, Colonial Migrants at the Heart of Empire, Puerto Rican Workers on U.S. Farms, published by the University of California Press. Ismael Garcia Colon, welcome to Working History.
Thank you for the invitation.
Of course, my pleasure. One of the main themes that your book engages with is the multiple challenges faced by Puerto Rican farm workers in the United States because of their status as both U.S. citizens and, as you discuss, perceived, quote unquote, others. To start us off, could you give our listeners a very quick primer, if you will, on how Puerto Rico came to be a U.S. colonial territory and how its residents then were ultimately granted U.S. citizenship?
Yes, Puerto Rico became part of the United States in 1898 as a result of the Spanish-American War. Some people call it the Spanish-Cuban-American War. Mm-hmm. So the United States invaded Puerto Rico, and as a result of this war, the United States became an empire. Puerto Ricans initially were not granted U.S. citizenship. Mm-hmm. There was this fear that people of African heritage will be part of, will become part of the United States nation. So the Congress and the president, they didn't want to grant citizenship. In 1984, the U.S. Supreme Court declared Puerto Ricans national. Mm-hmm. What that meant was that they were subjects of the United States, but not citizens, part of the United States for basically domestic purposes. Mm-hmm. And this happened when Puerto Ricans began to migrate to continental United States, right? That there was this question of what are we going to do with these new colonial subjects that we just acquire, and what is going to be the status of them? So initially, they were granted this national status. And in 1917, some people argue that the United States fear a German invasion of the island. Other people argued that the United States wanted to maintain Puerto Rico or Puerto Ricans as loyal subjects. Mm-hmm. And that was those were the reasons why Puerto Ricans became U.S. citizens. But in 1917, Puerto Ricans became naturalized citizens.
Okay.
Not native-born citizens. That happened until 1941, when they were included in the Immigration Act of 1940. And it wasn't until 1948 that Congress really clarified this status, because some people that were living out of the United States and out of Puerto Rico, they were basically stateless. Mm-hmm. And in 1948, Congress then clarifies that Puerto Ricans are native-born citizens.
Okay. So with that 1940-1941 shift from naturalized to native-born, was that also a product of the wartime crisis that was starting in that moment?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, the fear, again, that you needed to maintain these colonial subjects loyal to the nation was one of the reasons why they granted or extended the citizenship of Puerto Ricans. But it was also the lobby of the local colonial government with the federal agencies trying to give Puerto Ricans more rights within the U.S. nation.
Okay, that's interesting. When we think of Southern labor history, which this podcast focuses on, why is it important for us to, in your opinion, widen our circle to include places like Puerto Rico that might be seen as on the periphery of the U.S. South or of the global South, even geographically?
Well, first, there has been a long time connection between Puerto Rico and the southern part of the United States. This is since Spanish colonial times. From Puerto Rico, some expeditions during the colonial times were launched to what is now the United States. And Puerto Ricans migrated to places like in Florida, Ybor City, to work in the tobacco in Ybor City, for example, in the 19th century. In the earliest 20th century, the first Puerto Ricans recruited by the United States Employment Service during the first war, they were sent to war-related industries in the South, Kansas, North Carolina, Louisiana, and many died there as a result of the Spanish flu in 1918.
Which seems suddenly relevant, right, in the moment that we're living in. Yeah.
Yes. And after the mid-20th century, farm workers that migrated without contracts, without any kind of contracts between the government of Puerto Rico and farmers, they will first travel to Florida. And from Florida, they will trek north all the eastern seaboard, working in the harvest.
So basically what you're saying is that Puerto Rico and Puerto Rican workers have really been an integral part of Southern labor history right from the very beginning. So it makes sense to include them sort of in our scope of consideration. So let's really dive into your book a bit more and, you know, kind of fast forward a little bit from what you were talking about in terms of the Spanish-American War and then into 1917, and but not so far beyond when Puerto Rican citizens became official citizens, if you will, of the United States. And your book largely looks at the post-World War II period. So can we talk a little bit about, and can you tell us what, and you briefly just mentioned this before, but what was the farm labor migration to the U.S. like up to this time, so sort of in the pre-World War II period, and how were or were not, as the case may be, Puerto Rican workers, Puerto Rican farm workers specifically, part of this mix?
Well, as soon as Puerto Rico became part of the United States, labor recruiters landed in Puerto Rico seeking Puerto Rican labor. Initially in 1899, labor recruiters from Hawaii was already part of the United States, and the sugar company sent recruiters to Puerto Rico for the sugar plantation. And it was because first the Japanese had created a monopoly of labor and they wanted to break that monopoly. And secondly, because of the Chinese Exclusionary Act. So the sugar planters were recruiting Puerto Ricans and from other places around the world. Mm-hmm. So this is when Puerto Ricans are nationals. U.S. companies are recruiting them to Hawaii, but also U.S. sugar companies in Cuba, Dominican Republic, mm-hmm. and in some cases, in some plantations in Mexico. When they become citizens, they are sent to the South to this war-related industries. Mm-hmm. And in the 1920s, there's this recruitment of Puerto Ricans to Arizona and for the cotton plantations. But the problem was that they were already citizens. Mm-hmm. And they were promised things that were not true. And when they got there and they found the reality, they began to escape and leave the plantations for the cities. And mm-hmm. for the cotton planters, that was a disaster. And for them, since then Puerto Ricans were not a good source of labor.
Sure.
They began to complain. By 1928, in the hearings on immigration in the Western Hemisphere, farmers feared that the United States would restrict Mexican migration and that they would use Puerto Ricans and Filipinos. And so the farm lobby began to basically argue against Puerto Ricans because they were not deportable. Mexicans could be sent back if they were troubled. Puerto Ricans would stay and become country charges. Mm-hmm. So during the Depression, Puerto Rican labor was not basically used, and there are no recruiters to Puerto Rico. So in 1941, you have the Mexican Bracero program. You have also the United States recruiting West Indians to work in farms, but they are not recruiting Puerto Ricans. And the local colonial government is governor at the time, Rexford G. Togwell, one of the most radical New Dealers. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Togwell is lobbying the Office of Territory for the use of Puerto Ricans, but the farmers didn't want them. Mm-hmm. And since the farmers were in the boards of the Manpower Administration, they were able to block Puerto Ricans. And Puerto Ricans were recruited, but to a lesser extent in manufacturing and the manufacturing sector, mm-hmm. and not in farm labor. The recruitment of Puerto Rican in farm labor in large quantities to continental United States began in the post-war years. In 1945, 1946, labor recruiters began to arrive in Puerto Rico, and they were bringing workers. But sometimes they would promise salaries that were not true. Mm-hmm. The conditions that they were offered were not adequate for the workers. And these workers began to complain to the local government in Puerto Rico. The government of Puerto Rico then sent its Secretary of Labor, Fernando Sierra Verdecilla, to investigate this situation. And they found that it was true, that labor recruiters were abusing many workers. Mm-hmm. And the government of Puerto Rico then, in 1947, when the Mexican Bracero program is suspended temporarily, mm-hmm. the government of Puerto Rico then issues two laws. One law is Law 89 that restricts labor recruitment in Puerto Rico. Any labor recruiter had to be approved by the government of Puerto Rico. And Law 25 that created the Bureau of Employment and Migration. Mm-hmm. Basically, the local U.S. Kind of employment service, the local employment service in the islands. And with that, the government then creates this farm labor program.
Mm-hmm. And so how did that impact farm labor migration to the United States once those laws were passed? Did it facilitate more migration or less, or did it just manage it in a different way?
Well, it facilitated migration from Puerto Rico to the Northeast.
Okay.
Because actually, the government of Puerto Rico feared the Jim Crow South.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they basically stated, we are not going to send these workers to the South, not even Florida.
Okay.
And so the Puerto Rican migration to farm labor happens mostly to the Northeast. New Jersey and Southern New Jersey is still, from the late 1940s to the present, the center of Puerto Rican farm labor migration. So with that, what happened was that British West Indian farm labor migration gets restricted mm-hmm. in the Northeast of the United States because of Puerto Rican migration. In 1949, the Secretary of Labor, Fernando Sierra Verdecilla, reached an agreement with Robert Goodwin, the director of the U.S. Employment Service, to consider Puerto Rican domestic workers
uh-huh.
and grant Puerto Rican preference over what they call guest workers.
Okay. The farm workers themselves and their experiences are really central to the story that you tell in the book. And so could you, now that we have this framework of understanding the structure around, you know, how these workers are coming to the United States, could you walk us through what life was like for Puerto Rican farm workers in the U.S.? What sorts of work were they doing? You said they were coming to the Northeast largely. So what kinds of work were they doing? What were the conditions in which they labored? And, you know, anything else that you could tell us about their day-to-day lives, as you said, domestic workers from what was still in many ways considered a colonial outpost, if you will.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So Puerto Ricans, because they were migrant laborers, they wanted to work as many hours as they could so they could send money to their families.
Mm-hmm.
So most of them, to the present time, they work 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
Still, Puerto Rican farm workers, they work in a day from, say, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., 12 hours a day, especially when the harvest is very intense.
Mm-hmm.
And they will work until Sunday, maybe Sunday until 1 p.m.,
mm-hmm.
And they usually work in fruits and vegetables, mm-hmm. but also in tobacco. And this depended in the region, right? You mm-hmm. have in southern New Jersey workers in the vegetable harvest, also picking up blueberries.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In the northern part of New York, you have workers picking up apples.
Mm-hmm.
In the Connecticut River Valley, you had a lot of Puerto Ricans workers in the tobacco farms.
Mm.
Puerto Ricans that work in the tobacco farms in Puerto Rico will migrate to tobacco farms in the Connecticut River Valley.
Mm-hmm.
It really depended on the region. Like mm-hmm. in Long Island, in Eastern Long Island, you have them harvesting potatoes. And, you know, this is a really intensive work, sometimes bending their backs
mm-hmm.
Most of the day, carrying heavy loads of produce. But most of them did this because they wanted to improve their lives.
Mm-hmm.
They tell me that they were looking for buen ambiente, meaning a good environment, a good life,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So what I cover in my book is these feelings of hope that they had.
Mm-hmm.
And this hope of improving their life was what was driving them to migrate seasonally. Many of them had this idea that they will migrate, that is, they will get money, save money, and will be able to bring their families. And many did that.
Mm-hmm.
Many moved from the farms to the cities. Many kept moving back and forth and building their houses, buying land in Puerto Rico, opening mm-hmm. Small stores. But at the same time, they, you know, that they were working in this all the time. They felt like, many of them felt like living in a prison.
Mm.
And this is a topic that is recurrent in the interviews that I did, mm-hmm. and actually in the documents and newspapers of since the 1940s to through the 1980s, that the labor camps were like a prison for farm workers, and that they felt estranged from Puerto Rico, right? Mm-hmm. That they didn't speak the language. Some of them were without any families or friends. So this dialectic between the hope and the estrangement what shaped their experience in U.S. farm labor.
Right. Looking at their experiences from a worker management perspective, what were relations like between the farm workers and the farm owners and operators? Is it sort of a classic, labor management struggle, or was it different?
There's positive and negative sides of the story.
Yeah.
In the case of farmers, it was sometimes a headache to deal with Puerto Ricans because they will leave their job without finishing the contract, mm-hmm. Breaking their contracts. But at the same time, in the documentation that I have found, there are many, many incidents of wage theft and complaints mm-hmm. by workers. So the workers, it was common for workers to complain about abusive relations with the farmers, the farmers abusing them, not providing them adequate living places or worker conditions that were acceptable. Mm-hmm. But in the other side, I was able to interview workers in southern New Jersey that were migrating to the same farm that their parents or grandparents migrated in the 1950s.
That's interesting. Wow.
So I asked other farmers and I said, how do you get your workers? Were because my father used to bring them from this area in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. So that there are these long lasting relationships. Mm-hmm. And some workers will say, oh, because my boss, he has sent their children to Puerto Rico to spend the summer with my children. Hmm. Or the farmer speaks Spanish. Mm-hmm. They have these bonds have been created between farmers and farm workers that mm-hmm. in a way are paternalistic, right? Because
sure.
the farmers make sure to maintain these sources of labor.
So, and this seems very different, very different in a lot of ways from other groups of farm laborers that come to the United States, particularly guest workers who don't have, it seems, a similar degree of agency that Puerto Rican workers do by virtue of the fact that they are deportable. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely. What scholars Nicolas DeGeneva and Natalie Potts argue is that in the United States, there's this deportation regime. Mm-hmm. And this deportation regime also shapes the lives of U.S. citizens. So in the case of Puerto Ricans, this deportation regime shaped the relationship to farm labor. Sometimes I found this letter from the Attorney General of Pennsylvania in the 1950s complaining about the fact that Puerto Ricans would stay after the harvest. Mm-hmm. In other instances, farmers or the directors of labor camps will complain that Puerto Ricans could not be deported when they misbehave, mm-hmm. when they complain about the labor conditions. And they will say it clearly, that they will prefer, for example, the British West Indians, because they could be deported and they didn't want Puerto Rican farm workers. So Puerto Ricans were desirable when immigration restrictions were and still are imposed mm-hmm. on guest workers, and they were undesirable when the country opened the doors to guest workers.
So it's sort of a double-edged sword, right? That, you know, on one hand, they're desired, and the other hand, they're not. Okay, yes. So that's all very, very interesting. Before we wrap up for today, given the particular moment that we're in and the conversations around immigration policies that we're currently having, what do you see as an important takeaway or takeaways from the story that you tell in your book?
One thing is that if we wanted to understand the effects of open border policies, the case of Puerto Ricans in farm labor is a good way to understand the dynamics of having open border policies. Another aspect is that, unlike natives argue, it's not the immigrants who we should blame for the situation of citizens. It's actually elected officials and agribusinesses, right, that don't allow workers to organize, to have labor unions, to have decent labor conditions, to have access to health care and a minimum wage in farm labor.
That's definitely giving us something to think about. And hopefully our listeners will pick up a copy of your book, which was just published last month. Am I right? So
it's
very recent, but it's available. So thank you for taking the time to join us on this episode of Working History to discuss it.
Thank you again for the invitation.
Thanks again to Ismael Garcia Colon for joining us to discuss his book, Colonial Migrants at the Heart of Empire. And thank you for listening to this episode of Working History, a podcast on the New Books Network produced by the Southern Labor Studies Association. Become a member of SLSA online at www.southernlaborstudies.org and follow Working History on Twitter at Working History.
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. Again, if you missed tonight's broadcast of the Boomer Jones radio special, look for it on tomorrow's special Labor Day Pod Extra of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app, and even better, if you like what you hear, and we hope you do, please like it on your podcast app and pass it along. You can be part of Labor History Today by reading a short labor history item. Just shoot us a note, laborhistorytoday@gmail.com. Today's music is Which Side Are You On by the Kronos Quartet featuring Lee Knight. Labor History Today is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, working people's voices broadcasting worldwide 24 hours a day. You can find out more at laborradionetwork.org, where there are links to more than 60 labor radio and podcast shows. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Finch, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdat. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history, and see you next time.
Oh, workers, can you stand it? Oh, tell me how you can. Will you be a lousy scab or will you be a man? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, girls? Which side are you on?